So I'm going to present some sort of alternative scenario, alternative point of view on quantum critical, quantum phase transitions and quantum critical points. You'll see what the theory is, you know, as the talk progresses. But my aim is, you know, is actually to apply this kind of approach to quite broad class of systems. And not only, say, heavy fermions and, say, strontium ruthenium, this kind of materials which have been discussed in this meeting already, but also the systems such as two-dimensional helium-3, two-dimensional reaction gas, maybe even neutron stars, but they will not touch that. They're Fermi systems, after all. But so what is the advantage of these systems? The advantage is they're much simpler. Say, for example, helium-3, well, consists just of atoms of helium-3, nothing else. And two-dimensional reaction gas consists essentially of electrons on the surface of semiconductor. So this is much simpler, no F electrons. Okay, so there is no quantum physics. Okay, so life is much simpler. And there is no lattice. And helium is a liquid, so there is no lattice, there is no brilliant zone. Electrons on the surface of silicon is such that concentration is so low that, you know, it's way beyond the band structure. So basically, you can use parabolic dispersion law. So there is no lattice, there is no brilliant zone. Dispersion is isotropic. Okay, that means effectively one-dimensional. You need to care only about radial direction, not angular orientation. There's no band structure. So these are much simpler systems, and when we want to apply a theory, it makes sense to start try to apply it first to simple systems, okay? And then perhaps generalize to more complex systems where there are other factors coming into the play, and there's always question, you know, what is important and so on. Anyway, so I start first with showing you a couple, two slides on experimental data on helium-3 and two-dimensional electron gas, because these have not been discussed in this meeting before, as far as I understand. There was interesting questions. And very briefly, my goal is not to do a systematic survey of experiments, just to illustrate some main theoretical ideas. So I don't want to go anyhow deeply into discussion of experiments, but just to give you some examples. So anyway, so what is this? This is divergence of effective mass in two-dimensional helium-3 film. So this is helium-3 on a substrate, and substrates vary between different experimental groups. So what we change is density of helium atoms. So basically compress them, and as we compress them, at some point, there is some sort of when we have dilute helium-3 gas, it's liquid, okay? But as we compress it, it solidifies, makes transition to what they call solids, solidification transition, whatever it means. There is some transition, and which happens around here. But as we compress helium atoms, effective mass diverges at the transition, and beyond this point, presumably it is solid, it's solidified already.
Is that a specific heat effect?
Okay, now, this is measured by two different things. So there are circles and there are triangles. So circles are measured by measuring heat capacity, and triangles by measuring magnetization. So there are two different means, you know, specific heat and spin susceptibility. And you see they agree with each other, okay?
Isn't it true that there are also...
Yes.
Is this an unambiguous determination of the crystallization?
Okay. Okay.
I think they have some other signatures, different densities.
Let me put a general statement. Nothing in my talk will be unambiguous. You know, everything can be questioned. You know, everything can be questioned. For every single statement, alternative scenarios and alternative explanations are possible. Okay? So I'm not going to describe all of them. I'll present a particular point of view, but other points of view are certainly possible. There are certainly debates between experimentalists and between theorists and so on and so forth.
There was a specific question about solidification.
Yes.
What is known about the density around 5?
Not much, as usual. You know, when you're close to critical point, you know, radiation divergence single and so on, not much known. And also, I should say, very few groups in the world actually work on this. There are really, you know, less than, you can count them on, you know, less than fingers on one hand. Groups who are actually capable of doing this, actually doing this. There's, you know, many more people involved in this material. So, you know, experimental progress is, you know, quite slow. So not much is known. And you see, this is not systematic survey of, you know, Phillips fields of helium-3. This is just, you know, just a quick illustration that quantum critical points exist in other systems, okay? But, you know, the purpose of this talk is give, you know, some theoretical point of view, not go into much detail. So not much is known here, and surely lots of questions can be asked. Okay, another example is diverse effective mass in two-dimensional electron gas. So here we're talking about silicon MOSFET, electrons on the surface of superconductor. And again, there is something called metals and insulator transition, which was observed, you know, quite many years ago. Here the situation is opposite. When we have dense electron gas, it is a metal, it's a kind of weakly correlated, so to say, and then as we decrease density, make then becomes strongly correlated because of long-range Coulomb interaction. So at some point, at a certain concentration, there is transition. So in other words, here it is weakly correlated, as we decrease density, it becomes progressively more correlated. At some point, there is transition from metal, this metallic phase, low density, high density, and insulation phase at low density. And originally, they were determined by measuring temperature dependence of resistivity. Resistivity goes down or up with decreasing temperature. But that's not really a good criterion. So with the time, people refined experiments and started to measure quantities which are more, I would say, more informative and also thermodynamic quantities. Notice, by the way, I will systematically avoid discussing transport data in my talk. I will try to stay as much as possible to thermodynamic data. So previous slide was specific heat and skin susceptibility, both thermodynamic quantities. These are also thermodynamic quantities, basically skin susceptibility. So there are two plots. This is published 2002, this is very recent, 2005. But they are consistent. Point is they are consistent. So what happens is, as density approaches to some critical density, skin susceptibility seems to diverge. Okay, of course it doesn't reach infinity. I mean, we never see infinity, but the trend is certainly there. And skin susceptibility can be written as a product of effective masses and G factor. And what really diverges here is, or at least it enhances, is effective mass. So effective mass gets enhanced, whereas G factor stays pretty much constant. Okay.
Is this bigger crystallization?
Yes, it could be. It could be. It could be. So it's very big. This is a very big question. What is the nature of insulation phase? And of course, the first thing that comes to mind, Wigner crystal, because it should be over there, right? So it first comes. But somehow, I'm not sure why, but most people in that field would disagree, would argue with that. They say, no. Monte Carlo people tell you, Wigner crystal is way, to very low densities, It's not at this density. It's somewhere down the way.
So what's the RS here?
Well, look,
eight.
Okay, yeah, eight. My brain is not good at keeping numbers.
Peter,
okay, yes.
There was, you mentioned Monte Carlo.
Yes.
Did Monte Carlo people say anything what happens at the rest of order 10? Did they see anything like that?
Well, the problem is, first of all, they cannot calculate effective mass in principle because because mass is a spectrum of excitation. They calculate ground state using some trial functions. They can say something about ground state, but not about excitation spectrum. So they, by definition, cannot calculate effective mass.
Can they say something about ground state stability?
Actually, I think susceptibility is also about excitation spectrum. So they can tell ground state energy. They can calculate ground state energy and say whether this energy is better than that energy.
They can calculate ground state energy in the field and then just
right? Yeah, but anyway, problem with this, I don't really believe in West Monte. My talk is not about Monte Carlo. What I tell you is there are quantum critical points in two-dimensional semiconductors. That's it. So there is life beyond Heaven-Hermann. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay? And so this just gives some motivation for looking at the simple systems. Okay? So let's move on to the theory. Okay, that's just an introductory motivation. How we can explain these kind of things? Oops, no, that's not what I meant. Okay, now, so if my point is the following. If you study only Heaven-Hermanns or some systems like that, you might be tempted to develop theory based on localized spins, quantum physics, all that kind of stuff. But if you discuss helium and electron, three-dimensional electron gas, there's no electron physics. So we need some different starting point trying to explain this phenomenon, right? And so my starting point will be Landau Fermi liquid. Because I'm a rather conservative person. So what I will try to do in this talk, to kind of stretch Landau theory as much as possible, trying to explain this. And see how far I can go, without breaking the fundamentals of Landau theory. Okay? And what is actually Landau theory? Landau theory has kind of two there is a broad definition, Landau theory, of Fermi liquid. Okay? There is broad definition, there is narrow definition. Okay? Broad definition is the following. It's quasi-particle picture is valid. So we have quasi-particles that occupy Fermi sphere and so on. So it's basically that saying that interactional fermions are qualitatively similar, very similar to non-interacting fermions. That's kind of broad philosophical definition, okay? Quasi-particle picture. However, if you come to experimentalists and tell experimentalists this, experimentalists will say, okay, that's nice philosophy, but can you give me some predictions that I can measure and compare with experiments? And here comes narrow definition. We say, sure. For example, spin susceptibility would be constant as function of temperature. And specific heat will be proportional to temperature, so specific heat will be, you know, divided by temperature will be constant, okay? And so on. So this is you will tell experimenters, these are the signatures of Fermi liquid. If you see this, well, it looks like it's Fermi liquid, okay? However, these constants, what are these constants? These are basically density of state, right? And density of state is inversely proportional to Fermi velocity, okay? So these statements imply, that's what makes it narrow, that Fermi velocity is non-zero. So if Fermi velocity is non-zero, then you have finite density of states and you have these predictions, okay? But the fact that Fermi velocity is non-zero, technically speaking, is second, you know, extra assumption related to quasi-particle picture, okay? You may have quasi-particle picture and somehow, occasionally, you know, accidentally, Fermi velocity might vanish. So let me give you a very well-known example.
Yeah, me too.
Yes, so let me continue. You will see, I will give you an example, you know, it really goes by examples.
Sure.
An example is something called Lipschitz topological phase transitions, okay? Very, very old stuff. Lipschitz topological transitions. And you will see in a moment that, you know, this is, they give you some sort of critical point, quantum critical point. So what Lipschitz said? Well, he said, well, let's suppose we have some Fermi surface. For example, it has consists of two parts, okay, so consists of two pockets, okay, so that's Fermi surface written, drawn in momentum space. And as you change, so the energy distortion here, energy as function of momentum, would look something like, let's see, would look something like this. So that will be chemical potential, okay? I mean, going in this direction. So there is one Fermi surface, another Fermi surface. But then you change chemical potential to this point. And as you progress with increased chemical potential, these two Fermi surfaces may connect, right? So you may go to a point where these two Fermi surfaces merge, like this. They touch at some point. At this point, when they touch, you see velocity here is zero. Well, simply because it's a maximum, it's extremum, well, excitable point of the electron distortion. Okay, so there are certain points, and in fact, they surely exist in the Brillouin zone for sure, where just bend distortion vanishes at a particular point. Okay, so this is stable point, one hole, etc. Stable point. Okay, and as you increase chemical potential further, then you have merged. Fermi surfaces, so two become one. So basically evolution goes like this. Okay? By the way, did I tell you that this talk is actually about string theory? Okay? Anyway, so point is, when these two Fermi surfaces touch, at this point, well, we generally write distortion law as some, you know, Fermi velocity times P minus Pf or something like that. But in this particular point, the first term vanishes. So you have to go to a second term, just a second. So you get some px squared plus minus py squared. So just a second, let me just finish the sentence. So Lipschitz said, when the first term vanishes, you have to go to a second term, which is the quadratic, and recalculate, you know, redo calculations, for example, chi, etc. Okay?
And
you find the following. For example, in two-dimensional case, a density of states, okay, has logarithmic divergence, mu minus mu critical. So if you measure, for example, spin susceptibility, okay, if you measure spin susceptibility as function of mu at some low temperature, you have some sort of logarithmic divergence when mu is equal to mu critical, okay? And as function of temperature, if you measure chi as function of temperature, would be chi go like logarithm of temperature if you are sitting right at the point. So when you will see some behavior which is different from conventional behavior, and it happens at a particular point. So by all means, this you will call this quantum critical point.
Can I?
Yes.
I'm confused.
Yes.
This is some kind of rigid, non-interacting behavior.
Yes, absolutely.
Happen to be a particular way, and then
yes.
You get this divergence.
Yes.
Lado Fermi liquid starts with some interacting
yes.
Hamiltonian,
yes.
And I integrate out somehow this high energy
yes.
Degrees of
yes.
I end up with the effective Hamiltonian, and
yes.
Presumably that sort of relies on the fact that I can do it
mm-hmm.
without yeah. running into any trouble. The arrive mm-hmm. at the low energy theory, which has well-defined quasi-particles as excitations.
Yes.
So this example is an example of which exactly in the Landau theory of Fermi liquid?
Okay, so what I'm point is, in this example,
quasi-particles,
let's say quasi-particles. You may have, this example of situation, where quasi-particle picture is perfectly valid. But for some almost accidental reason, for some reason, velocity happened to vanish. So predictions for observable quantities like chi, specific, etc., are different from this.
Right, Victor, but the question was this. What you present is not Fermi liquid theory, it's a Fermi gas theory.
Okay, there is no interaction yet. I didn't put interaction. Okay.
So the statement of Landau theory was that if everything is okay with the Fermi gas, Fermi liquid has the same properties as the Fermi gas. Now you have Fermi gas different properties.
Okay.
So it's not an example of...
Second point is to now convince us that this that the quantum numbers which describe this Fermi gas are robust against interactions and then
I need to introduce interaction next. I can't introduce any interaction yet.
Right.
I mean, okay, this is just the warm-up, just this, appetizer. Okay, but now let's go to the first course. Okay, we have the first course and second course. Okay, let's go to the first course. Okay. Now, so this, of course, it happens in an isolated point. We have some brilliant zone, of course there is a saddle point somewhere, but it's an isolated point. But now, so in other words, this singularity happens at a one point, okay? But now I'm going to generalize this to a line. Because let me consider now this system, which are isotropic. Because they're isotropic just by symmetry. If, say, velocity vanishes at one point, for some reason, it must vanish on the whole line, on the whole circle, okay? So in other words, when I consider isotropic systems, my distortion, because of symmetry, is just effectively one-dimensional. So I draw a plot, epsilon as function of momentum. Well, it's basically some parabolic distortion, so it's chemical potential. In fact, I typically will measure epsilon from chemical potential, but anyway, it's trivial. So here, so we have this kind of distortion, okay? And now, suppose, because of interaction, I will show this in a moment, Fermi velocity start to decrease. Okay, so basically we want to somehow make it vanish, or perhaps even change sign. Okay, and so how this is going to happen? Well, obviously, just topologically, if Fermi velocity decreases, inevitably it has to go like this, and something like this, and then if you do it, if you push it further, eventually it might get to a situation where it goes like this. Okay, so at this point, Fermi velocity vanishes. But, as you see just from this picture, necessarily, you must go to the higher order terms of expansion. And these terms will be not quadratic, as in the case of Lipschitz, but cubic. So this is cubic inflection point, right, just pictorially. So energy in the vicinity of this point must be written as some sort of coefficient, let's call it C3, or some coefficient, P minus P of Q. Okay? And so, if it happens so, then you'll have to recalculate all those responses, specific heat, etc., with this kind of distortion, cubic distortion. You will surely get some stronger divergences here than Lipschitz had in isolated point, okay? So that will be the first part, yeah.
Right, but I don't want to disturb you, but I think this example and what you presented now are two qualitative differences. Because here you are saying that everything is okay with the Fermi gas, quadratic distortion. You increase interaction, at some point you break Fermi liquid theory.
Okay, wait a second. As I said, there is broad and narrow definition. All I'm trying to do is I want to make Fermi velocity go into zero. I don't want to break quasi-particle picture. I want to keep quasi-particle picture, but make velocity go to zero. So the question is, how I can make velocity go to zero? And I do this within the Landau Fermi liquid theory due to interaction. So let's introduce some interaction. Okay? So, as you know, Landau Fermi liquid theory starts with some functional, some energy functional. So Landau says there is some, let's say, zero temperature. First we do zero temperature, then we'll do non-zero temperature. There is some energy functional or occupation numbers n of k. And Landau said that if you make variation of this, you get distortion. Epsilon of k is variation of total energy respect occupation number. That gives a quasi-particle distortion. And there is an interaction function, P prime, which is second derivative with respect to delta P and delta P prime. Okay, so that's what Landau said. And in fact, if you want to, I will consider a simple toy model, okay, just to get the idea. The aim is not here to get very realistic, but rather to get message in the simplest model. The simplest toy model would be the following. Now, Landau didn't tell us what is this energy function, except you have to calculate it. Okay, but Just as a third model, we can consider a function which consists of just these two terms. Give you first and second derivative, because that's all you need. So that will be something like, let's see, epsilon p0 n of p, that's bare dispersion of electrons, times fpp prime n of p prime, interaction. Of course, there are integrals, dp and dp prime. So this is basically, in fact, this is not Hartree-Fock Hamiltonian, Hartree-Fock-like Hamiltonian. And so you can take variation and we'll get these terms. Okay? So, what I want to do, I want to find, so if I take variation, then this energy would be equal to epsilon p0 plus, I take variation of that, it would be f of pp prime, n of p prime, integral d pp prime. Okay, so that's your new distortion, you know, distortion modified by interaction. Okay, and if you differentiate this g epsilon over gp, you get term velocity. Okay, we get velocity and so on. So this is basically this reproduces standard quantum theory. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So in other words, this approach is essentially it's really Hartree-Fock-like approach. It's very simple-minded. You know, very simple-minded.
So you assume that pf by itself doesn't depend on m. Otherwise, it would not be able to integrate.
What does depend?
F by itself doesn't depend on n. Otherwise, it would not be able to integrate.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Landau said that this is general functional. So in principle, f is in could be itself a function of n. Mm-hmm. But say let's keep it simple and stop here. Okay. So let's keep it constant. Exactly. In principle, yes. No, but
it's not that he said it. I mean, it's not a voluntary decision to stop there. It's just it's. If you look at the next terms, they...
Yes, I'm perfectly, you know, okay, let's do this. I will look at the first term, and, you know, then we can, you know, or somebody can look at the further terms and so on. I just really want to keep it simple. I really want to play with the toy model, okay, which, you know, as simple as possible, not necessarily realistic. Yes, it has to be calculated in particular models and so on. Okay, but what I'm saying is that this model, you know, captures the basic, you know, the basic ingredients of Landau theory, but how realistic is the second question. Anyway, so let's look at this. Now, let's do some kind of, again, model simple calculation. Now, to do this, of course, we need some assumption about function f. We need to say something about interaction. Okay, we don't really know what interaction is. For one thing, systems are very different. One is Coulomb interaction, one is kind of contact interaction, van der Waals, and so on. I mean, it's a very different system. And second is f is renormalized. So again, we don't know very well. So let's, again, put some simple toy model, okay? So let's plot f as function of q. Q is transfer of momentum. Let's assume it's q minus q prime, because that would be q. So q is a transfer of momentum, okay? And let's consider, just for simplicity, the case when interaction is kind of has this kind of shape. It's fixed at zero momentum and has some widths, let's call it q star, okay? Some characteristic widths in momentum space. In fact, why don't we replace it just by rectangular shape? Again, this is just to make consideration simple. So it has some height v star and width q star, okay? Just to make life simple. And see what kind of results you'll get from this formula if you use this kind of interaction, okay? By the way, what I'm doing here, I'm reproducing the paper by Nazir of 1992, Journal de Physique, which is really, you know, very, very excellent paper. I mean, I highly recommend it. If anybody's interested in the subject, that's the paper to read first. Okay, so let's look at this. So this term is correction, it's called delta p. This is correction to the energy compared to the bare interaction, right? And if we make this approximation, and we're talking at zero temperature, this term has a very simple pictorial geometrical meaning, okay? So let's draw the Fermi surface. So this is Fermi surface, okay? Yeah, here. Now, all states are occupied, n is occupied, right? N is 1, is 0 outside. So states inside the Fermi surface are occupied. Okay, then we pick some point p. Okay, we pick some point P, and we want to ask, how big is this correction?
Sorry.
Yes?
Isn't that the problem of the screening of the charge in the Fermi gas, if I look at it this way?
No, this is just Hartree-Fock. No, this is a toy, Hartree-Fock model.
If I were to solve the problem of screening,
yes,
wouldn't I say that my interaction looks sort of exactly like that, it's screened at some characteristic wave vector?
Yes. But keep in mind that this is in momentum space. It's not in real space. It's momentum space. I mean, you might say it has characteristic range.
Yeah. It's one over Q square.
Yeah.
Plus Q.
Yeah.
The interaction and Landau function are two different.
Well, again,
but that's precisely what I'm trying to understand. So you call it a Hartree-Fock Hamiltonian. And likely, if I were treating it as a Hartree-Fock Hamiltonian, what you're doing is solving problem screening, or not?
If you like it. If you like it to call screening, that's fine. I mean, I really don't care about this term.
Is it still fair to say that this is too immortal?
Yes.
But if you do brute force perturbation theory on, say, tracking electrons, assuming RS is small, you don't get this kind of thing.
Okay. Is question a point? What is F for Coulomb interaction? Is that the question?
I think this
is the question. What is function F if we start from Coulomb interaction? Is that a question?
Well,
you can know the answer. Give it to us.
No, I don't. I mean, this is a very complicated. That is a very complicated question. You know, treating Coulomb interaction is a very complicated procedure. We don't have full answer to that.
Problem is that if you do brute force perturbation theory, small errors, you get effective mass that goes down, not going up. But in any self-consistent scheme, you see that mass first goes down and then starting going up. Then you start asking questions about how good is self-consistency.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the Landau theory is very different.
Exactly.
B and B prime are confined to the Fermi surface itself, and then the expands in spherical Raman.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, Landau told us, you have some sort of interaction function. You have some sort of interaction function. Landau didn't tell us what is the shape of this function, right? But it's got to have some shape, right? So we've got to get some shape. And I say, why don't we try this simple approximation for that shape? Whether we can reproduce the shape in any particular microscopic model like Coulomb or van der Waals for helium or whatever for heavy fermions. Okay, and how wide it is, what is the height, what is the profile? Yeah. It's a separate question. But we've got to have some sort of shape, right?
When you expand in spherical harmonics, then M star is in the definition of partial components of Landau.
That's right.
Yeah. But anyway, my point is, this function F got to have some sort of shape, right? Okay, so why don't we approximate it this way, play with the same model, and then discuss to what extent this time model may possibly apply to any kind of real system, okay?
Sorry to bother you. But now, you assume that this also applies to quasi-particles away from the Fermi surface.
Yes.
There as well,
yes.
Which is again a deviation from that.
Yes. Right. That's true. That's true. Yes. I will apply it away from the Fermi surface. Not too far away, but yes, but away from the Fermi. I will be not sitting on the Fermi surface. I'll be moving around it. That's certainly true. Okay. But anyway, so let's evaluate how big is this correction. Okay. So this correction has a very simple geometric meaning. It's just overlap of two circles, because if I start from given point P, some fixed point P, I can draw a circle, radius of my interaction, which is Q star, okay? So this interaction is non-zero only within this area, within this circle. So the whole integral then measures just the area of the overlap, okay? So, this integral is very easy to evaluate. It's nothing but the area of overlap between two circles, and that's it, right? And that very simple toy approximation, okay? Now we see the following, that if this point P is well inside the Fermi surface, okay, then what happens? Let me plot delta E correction to the energy, just function of P. If you're well inside the Fermi surface, this circle is completely inside. So area of overlap is just area of that circle. Okay, so it gives you some number, I don't know, V star or something like that, some number. So it stays constant. But as you approach the Fermi momentum, then this circle of interaction starts to stick out of the Fermi surface, right? The area starts to decrease, so it starts to decrease. And when the circle is completely outside the Fermi surface, it drops down to zero. The point is that this kind of Hardy-Fock-style correction to the energy depends on momentum, on where you are, where the point is inside or outside of the Fermi surface. So anyway, this is correction to the energy of the particle due to Hardy-Fock term, or Landau interaction term, okay? So now, if you plot the total energy of the particle, you'll get the following. We'll get the bare term, epsilon zero, okay, the original term, plus this addition. So these points below the Fermi surface will be shifted. They will be pushed up to some level like this. So this shift is delta epsilon. But above the Fermi surface, they will be not shifted, delta epsilon is zero. So here we stay on that curve. And we're going to have to interpolate somehow. Okay, so what you see is just because of that, and so the slope here would inevitably be smaller. Okay, to put it a different way, we can calculate correction to the velocity, so we can differentiate this and calculate delta v, g delta epsilon gk. So we differentiate this curve in k in momentum p. Okay, p. Okay, so as you see, the slope is negative. So what we find is a negative correction to the velocity, well around here. So the total velocity v, which will be v zero. Plus delta v would decrease. Okay.
Quick question, because you several times mentioned Hartree versus Landau theory.
Yes.
Is it some form of effective potential theory where you have basically Hartree theory and you just assume that further interaction and use transform in initial interaction into some effect?
Yes, yes, exactly. You start from Hartree theory, okay, and then you say, well, you know, further correlations will, you know, modify it somehow. But, you know, it will say something, hopefully something close to it or something like that. You know, I'm not trying to connect this F with my macroscopic interaction. I'm not trying to do this. I'm saying I have something which, you know, looks, you know, probably something close to Hartree in some way, qualitative way, okay? So as you see, because of this Hartree-style interaction or Landau interaction, whatever you call it, if you take it into account, then it decreases velocity around the Fermi point, okay? And if you... And if now suppose parameters of this interaction depend on like strength, for example, height or width, let's say height, depend on some control parameter like density or doping or pressure or something of that, some control parameter. So these parameters of interaction change with this change. Yes?
Just to remark, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
I think the way we tend to be taught Landau theory deals with f of PM2 prime. Is with a function on the surface.
That is true. Exactly, that's true. When you read textbook, they tell you that, okay, everything is confined to the Fermi surface. That's what textbooks tell you. So you got to set this momentum on the Fermi surface. That will be P prime, and everything depends on the angle between P and P prime. Now that's what textbooks say, right? Of course, they equivalently can rewrite in terms of Q. I can introduce transfer momentum Q and, you know, relate, you know, angle, express angle in terms of Q or vice versa, okay? Yeah. But wait a second. But Landau theory, you know, as I recently formulated, you know, is not actually confined to the Fermi, you know, it's not necessarily confined to the Fermi level. These are very general expressions. These are general expressions, okay? That's what I'm doing.
Yeah,
okay?
I'm just inviting you to underline the difference between this and...
Yes, absolutely. What I'm doing, I'm moving my momentum away from the Fermi. I'm moving this in this direction.
Yes.
I'm moving it in. So when I'm doing this, I'm moving the normal to the Fermi surface. That's exactly right. Yes.
In effective potential theory, you don't have to.
I
think this is an important point.
Yes.
And another point is that as you change the slope of the dispersion near the Fermi surface, your functional f does not change. Is that?
Yes. That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, more precisely, let's say I increase the height of my potential. Let's say my potential gets stronger. Okay. So the height of this correction increases. So the height of this potential of interaction function increases, and so correction increases, and then velocity decreases and goes to zero. But otherwise, it doesn't change.
Wait, it goes back to the question. Mm-hmm. In principle, this function is obtained by integrating something away from the Fermi surface. Mm-hmm. Now, you change the dispersion everywhere below the Fermi surface. Mm-hmm. You change the slope around the Fermi surface, and you're saying that the effective interaction did not change.
No. We have to recalculate it. Of course, we have to recalculate itself consistently. Uh-huh. What I'm saying is that when I change my control parameter, Let's say my system gets stronger correlated. I change density, it becomes stronger correlated. What this interaction F becomes stronger. Okay, it may change its shape.
I'm talking about self-consistency rather than.
Yes, of course. Of course, F and everything must be calculated self-consistently. That's what Landau. I'm not doing it.
Okay.
Right.
That's all I want.
I'm taking is only doing. I'm doing textbook stuff, just slightly generalizing it by moving away from the Fermi surface. That's all I'm doing. Okay, otherwise it's completely textbook stuff. No textbook actually show you explicitly the self-consistent procedure, right? They tell you it should be self-consistent, but you know.
Well, the only way you can do this is perturbation theory.
Diagram technique. Well, actually not.
Any perturbation theory.
Yeah, actually there are other things like density functional, there are other techniques, density functional material. Well, anyway, so what is my point is, if interaction is strong enough, then you may get to a point, then you may get to inflection point where Fermi velocity vanishes. So, okay, so that would be what I would call a critical point. Whatever it means. Mm-hmm. But then if it happens so, then you must take into account cubic distortion in this cubic term in the distortion of energy, right? And once you have this, then a simple exercise, you can recalculate those answers. What is your spin susceptibility, what is your specific heat, and so on, okay, with this distortion. It's very easy to recalculate because, for example, if you apply, say, magnetic field, I mean, Zeeman magnetic field, so, you know, mu Mohr Bangerton H, so you squeeze and spins up and down, okay? So, how many spin? What is your magnetization? So magnetization is the number of, let's say this will be spin down and this will be spin up. So how many elections you have here? Well, you have distortion, it looks like. So you have to equate this to, well, magnetic field, Bohr magneton magnetic field. I mean, I'm doing very crudely, okay? So the number of elections that satisfy this relation would be magnetization, would be proportional basically h to the power of 1/3, okay? So the number of elections would be cubic root of h. So if magnetization is proportional to h to the power 1/3, if you want define susceptibility, if you want to differentiate this, it will be 1/h/2, okay? So susceptibility will be a very nonlinear function of h. Now, if you want temperature, you might put temperature here now. If you put temperature, well, the same story, temperature broadens energy interval. So by the same token, susceptibility as function of temperature will go like chi over 2/3. Okay, so in fact, it's actually very simple. Once you put temperature, you start getting some slope here. So the density of states, basically, is proportional to chi to the power 2/3. It's a very simple exercise. Velocity is p minus pf squared, if you differentiate this, and then you can get 2/3. Anyway, and so c over t would be also proportional to 2/3, so specific root will be 1/3, okay? So anyway, so this is a bunch of predictions, right, which experimenters can measure, right? And they're quite different from this, right? So you might say, oh, this is non-Fermi liquid, right? But it's derived using, you know, well-defined quasi-particle picture. It just velocity happened to be zero, we have to do cubic curve. Now, question is, has this anything to do with experiment? Okay, and the answer is yes. In fact, it is observed experimentally. So let me go to the next slide. Okay, so this is experiment for helium-3. Okay.
Could you get the middle light switch on the left?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, thank you. Good point. Okay, so this is data for helium-3. Okay, what we see here, so this is M is basically magnetization, so if you divide by magnetic field, that will be susceptibility. So it's basically still susceptibility as function of temperature. Now, both are logarithmic scale, the temperature and the susceptibility logarithmic scale, measured in a wide range of temperatures. So these three curves are for three different concentrations. So this is low concentration and higher concentration, okay? So let's start from this low concentration, it's diluted and kind of good Fermi gas or something. Okay, now, what is this part? This part corresponds to 1/T. This is log-log scale, right? So you can draw a straight line. This corresponds to 1/T. This is non-degenerate Fermi gas. You see, Fermi energy of helium is very low. So you can easily go above Fermi energy. In this case, you have classical fermions, classical Fermi gas, non-degenerate. And it has, since susceptibility is Curie-like, because this is just a free non-degenerate electrons. And the slope of this line.
Fermi energy from this density.
Well, Fermi energy is this. In fact, you see the solid line? The solid line. This is theoretical fit. If you just take, you know, if you calculate spin susceptibility for Fermi gas in a wide range of temperatures, both below and above Fermi energy. Fermi energy is here. Basically, this is the Fermi energy.
Mm-hmm. So 100 okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100 millikelvin. 100 millikelvin. This is Fermi energy. So the here we're above Fermi energy, not surprising to get 1/T, that's just non-degenerate Fermi gas. No big surprise, right? So then we decrease temperature, and what we get is constant. You see, sensitivity is independent of time. That's Pauli. That we all know, okay? But then, as you go to even lower temperature, you see, it starts to increase, starts to go up, right? So why is that? Well, of course, people can propose different explanations, but in this picture, it's very simple. This dispersion curves, right? So it curves like this. So you go like this, but in the vicinity of Fermi, in the very narrow, in a narrow vicinity of Fermi energy, well, velocity is actually smaller. So in other words, here you probe susceptibility in this range of energy, and here you probe it in this range, velocity decreases, so susceptibility goes up. Okay? Now, what happens if you increase density? So in other words, increase interaction between electrons, compress them. Okay, well, we have 1/T, we get this Pauli term area kind of decreases, but this part increases substantially, and this even higher density even more. So bottom line, as you compress it to this kind of density, you have, you know, strong enhancement of low temperature susceptibility part, and it's kind of straight line, so you can draw a line here. And line is, you know, temperature power 2.16, right? So what is our prediction for susceptibility in this theory? Well, prediction is chi to the power 0.666, okay? So in other words, the exponent 2/3 predicted by, if you assume that system reaches inflection point, then we should expect power 2/3, and power 0.6 is not very far from that.
And at what densities you are?
Density is this.
Is it the same density where mass diverges?
Yes. However.
No, wait a second.
No. Point is this. The curve. The curve I showed you in the beginning of the talk was measured by a different group on a different substrate with different number of layers and so on and so forth. Okay, so these are different groups. These people, this is Godfrey and Bunkov, etc., they do not show a plot of divergence of mass as function of density. You see, in this paper, there is no plot of M star as function of control parameter.
Is there any plot of M star as a function of temperature?
In this paper, there is no plot of effective mass. I mean, they just don't tell you what
to do. Are they doing the same experiment?
Measurements, experimental techniques.
Are they doing the same helium atoms on the same surface?
No. Substrate is different. No, substrate is different. Helium 3 atoms are the same, but substrate is different. Experimental techniques is different, and so on. So point is, I cannot make precise connection. Let me put it this way. In the first plot, I was showing effective mass. How effective mass was determined? It was determined from measurements of specific susceptibility. Okay. And on this curve, what is effective mass? In fact, I can tell. I think what the previous plot was showing, they were measuring this part. Yeah. In fact, temperatures in that first paper were substantially higher. These people are kind of recordsmen. They can go to extremely low temperatures. The first paper stopped around here, so they basically measured that slope. So in that paper I was showing you, this slope was increasing. Okay. So they were showing divergence of that part, not this part, because they cannot reach that low temperatures. Okay. But my point is, the curve is completely nonlinear. Definition of effective mass at some point becomes kind of meaningless.
It's a little bit. Here's what I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Suppose that since you're saying that the constant term goes up, mm-hmm. this is well understood.
Yes.
Okay. We just said.
Yes.
It constant goes up.
Yes.
So I would say that you are not at the critical point because constant term is still there.
Yes.
You just approach critical.
Yeah. In fact.
Mm-hmm. So normally at the very low temperature, mm-hmm. yes. you see behavior that is not critical.
Saturation.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's opposite. That you go below the point where susceptibility is a constant, and from this constant you determine effective mass. Then you go to even low temperatures, and then see behavior that follows.
Well, that's in accordance with this picture. That's in agreement with the picture that Victor drew. That far away from the firm surface, you have more or less all dispersion.
Yes, you measure this part. You measure this part.
And
you're going to close into this. So point is, your curve is very nonlinear. So there is no single definition. This part measures that slope. And this slope by itself decreases. But the low temperature part measures this slope, which decreases even faster and fun divergence.
Okay.
No, you're always at the inflection point at your Fermi surface.
Yes.
We assume inflection, you're always at the interesting
point. Yes, we assume that inflection point is at the Fermi surface, right. That's an important point. Okay. Yeah.
Let's suppose you probably have to, we have to talk at some point about potential microscopic models,
yes.
potential microscopic
yes.
calculations of
right.
Otherwise, this is just.
Yes, okay, now let's put it this
way. I'm just prepared. Mm-hmm. But there will probably be some, if that exists, there will be some set of parameters,
yes.
maybe tuning the system.
Of course. No, you compress now.
If you increase temperature,
yes.
there will be the usual quantum mm-hmm. critical physics. I think that's what Andrei was just referring to.
I'm not sure I understand what is usual quantum critical.
No. Yeah. Oh, well, I can explain that to you.
The question is this.
I'm not yet done. You also. So now, I need the system up.
Keep the system up, okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
In this picture, would you then expect that this renormalized band structure just stays put? Is this the implicit?
Okay. The point. I obtained this picture by putting an occupation number in this Landau self-consistent equation. Now, as temperature increases, occupation number changes just because of Stromow factor.
Yes.
So question is how this picture changes if I put temperature.
Yes.
This was done at zero temperature. Now I'm presenting data at finite temperature.
Yes.
So I have to put it in my equation. Now, yes, it absolutely has to be done. It has been done.
No, there are two aspects.
Yeah,
one is the temperature of the Fermionic degrees of freedom.
But what do you mean Fermionic degrees of freedom?
Oh, fermions. We're talking
fermions. Well, this is fermions.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's the temperature of those fermions, right?
Of this energy scale, you mean? This energy scale?
Of the fermions. That's the temperature of the fermions.
Temperature depends on NP.
If you wish so, of the Fermi factors.
Fermi density or what?
As of P has a temperature.
And an occupation number. Occupation number, yes. It has temperature factor, sure, yes.
But there will also, if I have a microscopic model,
yes.
I will expect somewhere that also
that this is not the only temperature dependent on the problem.
Okay, look, if you want to discuss microfluidic model, there is no time in this talk, you know, it's already...
I still want to.
Okay, let's do it after the talk. I cannot squeeze everything, you know.
This is a toy model.
Yes.
Related to the model.
Yeah.
We can either disagree completely.
Yes.
Or just listen to...
I don't want to disagree with you.
Okay. But, you know, I cannot squeeze...
No,
I cannot squeeze everything within 1 hour. I just want to bring basic principles and microscopic implementation. That's worked for 10 years, you know, or something, okay? I just want to bring basic principles. The same way as Landau theory. Landau theory didn't tell any microscopic picture of it, right? He presented framework, that's it. And then people worked for 40 years to make it, you know, to work it out. That's it, that's what I'm trying to do.
Fair enough.
Okay. Now, anyway, so this is data on specific heat, okay? So what we expect for specific heat, okay? When density is low, well, specific heat is linear temperature. It should be in Fermi liquid, of course. But as we increase density, it becomes nonlinear. It becomes nonlinear function of temperature, right? Well, you know, we don't have, you know, any detailed fields, but it's kind of qualitatively. If you say what expectation is specific, you should 1/3 of temperature, right? Well, you know, qualitatively, in the same, you know, goes in the right direction. I'm not claiming it's really 1/3, but it goes kind of same direction. It certainly becomes nonlinear.
Any sublinear goes in the same direction.
What?
Any sublinear will.
But that's exactly my point. It becomes sublinear. It becomes sublinear.
Victor,
yes.
Which is this? The authors of this paper, this particular paper, argued that they can feed the data by linear and quadratic behavior, and they made the story that they can extract t-square coefficient from the data, right?
Right. So okay, just a second. If you define effective mass as a slope of this curve, you see the slope goes up, and it kind of tends to go, well, kind of infinity. Well, of course, derivative of this term goes to infinity. So, in other words, it goes up, and diverges because it becomes sublinear. Okay, there's a trend, okay? I'm not saying there's a perfect fit of it, I'm saying the trend goes in the right direction. I'm trying to illustrate, not to prove it. Okay, perfect.
But if you are close to a so-called, let's say, a Wigner or crystal,
yes.
Then isn't that a stronger coupling
yes.
with the phonon of the substrate?
Yes.
And therefore, you should be able to see that in some experiments.
Yeah, so I agree. I mean, in fact, we proposed experiments. Yes, we proposed experiments to detect formation of density wave in both electron gas and helium. Point is, nobody, you know, there is no direct experimental evidence of formation of periodic structure. It is, you know, it's very difficult to observe directly. You can't do neutrons and stuff like that. And we propose experiments of doing this, but as of now, there's no direct experimental evidence for formation of periodic structure, but it's probably there, okay? Anyway, so let's move on, yes?
Quick question. So, from the experimental data that you showed,
yes?
It seems like, okay, so roughly when the temperature equals V Fermi times this Q star,
yes, yes,
then
yes.
You should see crossover.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely.
Does it fit the, did you do the scaling?
Well, but...
I know it's very...
The short answer is no. We do not have data, you know, we don't have actual data files, and we do not have, you know, manpower, etc., and, you know, to do actual
things. So it's just a simple thing, like where the Pauli behavior crosses it into Pauli.
Yes, okay. We plan
also
to,
where the
yeah.
maximum...
We plan to get in touch with Buinkov, get the data, and try to do things. You know, I'm presenting a framework. Okay. So anyway, so now the question is, suppose you push parameters any further, so velocity reaches to zero. But suppose you go push on, you keep compressing. So what is going to happen? Well, inevitably, velocity will become negative, right? So it will go something like this. It will go something like that. Okay? So at this point, velocity becomes negative. And so there are, you know, different points of view on that. If you call it mass, if you use your mass, effective mass is 1 over velocity, then mass becomes negative. To say, oh, negative mass doesn't make any sense, you know, nonsense and so on. But if you do the right, you know, if you use the right word, if you use velocity, velocity being negative, not a big deal, you know, in brilliant zone, velocity could be anything, you know. So just velocity becomes negative, and so that means that a Fermi surface experiences some sort of reconstruction. I mean, if you really, you know, if you try to follow this picture, okay, so now what happens is that occupation number is 1 here, then must be zero, you know, because the energy is, I mean, at zero temperature. There are no electrons should leave this, and then equal 1 again. So we have some funny kind of reconstruction of the Fermi surface. We get a circle where there is no occupation, and then the circle is occupation again. So, just a second. So this is basically some funny type, think of it as a funny type of Lipschitz reconnection. Remember, Lipschitz reconnected somehow. Here, because system is isotropic, because it's isotropic, well, it has to reconnect this way. So, question.
Some question was why, if the dispersion changes rapidly near the Fermi surface, why should they use M stars, one of the beam of the law of the definition, which is D2P?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I personally don't use M star. In fact, I hate the term mass. I avoid it as much as possible because mass is so much overused. I use velocity. Velocity, positive, negative,
linear. This is perfectly legitimate.
Yes.
As they go nonlinear.
Yes.
There is a band mass definition, which
yes.
is the second derivative of the dispersion.
Yeah.
In that case, there is no problem.
Okay, fine with me. Perfectly fine with me. I use velocity and that's it. I have no problems, you know. Okay. So anyway, so we get this some funny kind of reconstruction of the Fermi surface. But now, what you need to do, you need to check the following. Now, occupation numbers changed, right? In fact, we derived this distortion from this formula. We assumed that we made certain assumption of occupation number. In other words, it's one inside the Fermi surface. So we need to check for consistency. How this expression changes if, you know, is it consistent assumption? So now let's check it. So again, we put here this radius of interaction, which is something like this. Let's say we sit on the Fermi surface, for example, and then we do the area. So, my point basically, this is basically the area overlap, and then there is this area. So my point basically is the following. As long as this, the radius, I mean the size of this reconstructed focus is small, okay, then results do not change in the first approximation. Because this area, first of all, doesn't change, you know, it used to be shaded here, now it's shaded there, but the result is basically the same. And also velocity doesn't change, because what is velocity? It is velocity is how the area changes when you pull this point out, if you pull it out. Okay? Because these circles are kind of in extremal position. Okay, the first derivative vanishes. So this the presence of this reconstruction doesn't modify results in the first approximation. So in other words, this is actually self-consistent assumption as long as these areas are small. Okay? But that's not the main point. Now, but suppose we push even more. Suppose we make it stronger correlated. Then this area becomes not so small. Then become pretty substantial. I mean, okay? So that means the areas occupied for this by this, you know, reconstructed Fermi surface increases. Okay? And let's go to the limiting case. Suppose it increases so much that it becomes greater than radius of interaction. Okay, let's see what happens in this case. My point is we'll have a problem. Because now what will happen is this. That reconstructed Fermi surface would look something like, I don't know, something like this. And something like that. Now, let me compare with what we had before. The situation we started from was like this. We said everything is occupied inside the Fermi surface, and the area of overlap is this one. Now, and this the area is correction to the energy. So in the original case, when we move the circle out, right, the area decreases. Right? That means correction to the energy velocity is negative. Okay? But now we have the opposite situation. The area inside here is empty and here is occupied. If you take the sphere and move it out, you would increase the area. That means you get positive correction to velocity. Right? That means contradiction. We have contradiction. If you make assumption about these occupation numbers, you must conclude that velocity is negative, you must conclude that occupation numbers are different. But if you assume these occupation numbers, we conclude that this term gives positive velocity, so occupation numbers should not be like this, and so on. We get contradiction. How to resolve this contradiction? The solution is the following. It turns out that you have to abandon this idea that occupation number is either 0 or 1. You have to use some interpolated numbers. So occupation...
We're talking about 0 temperature, right?
We are talking about 0 temperature. We are talking about 0 temperature. So the numbers must go something like this. So this is 1. This is zero. So there must be some range of momenta, okay, where occupation number is intermediate between zero and one. Okay? So and zero temperature. So you may ask how come it can be? Well, let's look at the standard formula standard Fermi-Dirac occupation formula. Occupation number is one over E over T, right? So when T goes to zero, when temperature is zero, okay, if energy is negative, okay, if energy, so let me try to plot energy here. So this will be energy. Energy is function of momentum. So if energy is negative, occupation number must be 1, no way around it. If energy is positive, occupation number is 0, no way around it. However, if energy is strictly 0, then you have kind of singular limit, and poorly defined limit, you need to work on it. epsilon divided by T both go to zero. Energy goes to zero, temperature goes to zero. And because of that, you might have, depending how this limit is done, you can have intermediate numbers. So necessarily, where occupation number is intermediate, energy must be zero. Strictly zero, within a finite range of momentum. So in other words, instead of making this negative Fermi velocity system, self-consistently readjusts and make it like this. It's kind of resembling this kind of Van der Waals construction for the phase transitions. Okay, so this is kind of unstable branch of reconstructing this. So this was called fermion condensate. Well, this is just a term, fermion condensate, which was anyway. So that was Hodder and Shaginian, 1919. Okay, why fermion condensate? Because if you plot density of states of that of this thing, it would be some constant and delta function and then constant. So we have this flat portion of the distortion will give you huge peak on density of states. Okay, you might call it condensate, whatever it means. The terms, you know, maybe not the best. Okay, now. So that's what it is.
This is the functional peak at zero energy.
Zero energy and zero temperature. Okay? Now, one way to get it, another way to get this peak is the following. Again, a toy model. As you see, this situation happened when the size of this reconstruction was greater than the size of radius of interaction. Okay? So again, we can try a toy model, which was proposed by Nazir. So why don't we, again, to get some simple, why don't we squeeze, why don't we take this Q star to zero? So let's make interaction delta function in momentum state. Let's make it local momentum state, just to get some idea.
Before you go to the new model, will you tell us anything about the finite temperature?
Oh yes, absolutely, I will. That's in fact the main point. I mean, that's the main...
Yeah, maybe then...
Go to finite temperature. Okay, Phil, skip this one here. Point is, what I'm saying is that you can write this energy functional with certain FNM and just minimize it on computer, you know, numerically or analytically. The analytical model and numerical analyze, and you do see this. And there are tons of numerical pictures that confirm this. That's what I want to say. It's not just hand-waving argument. It's all confirmed on computer. Let's go to finite temperatures, because this is an extremely important question, and I will certainly want to discuss that. So let's go to finite temperature. Okay, so in this case, once you go to finite temperature, then, okay, let's see what I want to raise here. Let me raise this stuff. Then you have this equation, right? So this is the equation for energy, right? And you have Fermi-Dirac function for occupation number. So occupation number N of P is 1 plus epsilon of P divided by T. Well, it includes chemical potential, doesn't matter. Okay, it includes chemical potential. Now we have two self-consistent equations. Because you see, if you assume some distortion epsilon, then you calculate occupation numbers, and then you plug these occupation numbers and they tell you what is your energy distortion and so on. So you need to solve these two equations self-consistently at a finite temperature. Okay? Let me give you a qualitative idea how it works. Let's start with a simple idea. Let's, you know, simple-mindedly take the distortion law as it is. Distortion constant, no distortion. And plug it into this Fermi-Dirac formula at a finite temperature. Okay? Then you know what kind of occupation number you will get. Well, for negative energies, you get something like this. For this zero energy, you get 1/2, right? Mm-hmm. Because if energy is zero, temperature is finite, right? If you give it 1/2, you give it 1/2, and then you give it like this. So that's what you will get if you plug this distortion into this formula, okay? But this occupation number, which I drawn here, is not consistent with this equation, right? We already at zero temperature obtained the occupation number, which is the white line, obtained itself consistently. And, you know, it kind of has to be preserved at it has to evolve continuously. So if you have small, finite, but small temperature, it must be close to the original white line. It cannot jump from this line to this, whatever, kind of green line, okay? So in other words, it basically tells us that, in fact, occupation numbers must stay approximately the same. At the finite temperature, they must be approximately the same as they are at zero temperature. So this formula for occupation number can be inverted. You see, usually we use it like this. We say with given energy, we get occupation number. But we can equivalently rewrite it as distortion is temperature times logarithm 1 minus Np, Np. So this is just, we just express energy in terms of occupation number. Remember that energy here is obtained self-consistently, not rigidly set. And what I'm saying is that you start with some occupation numbers, intermediate occupation numbers at zero temperature. Once you increase temperature, the numbers stay approximately the same. That means your dispersion energy must adjust in this way. So in other words, we immediately find the dispersion, we see the dispersion is actually linear in temperature. You see, N epsilon depends on P because N depends on P, but prefactor is temperature. So in other words, at finite temperature, the picture becomes like this. This flat line acquires a slope proportional to temperature, and then it interpolates to this. And this is a self-consistent kind of solution of this equation, and again, was verified on the computer and so on and so forth.
What it gives for specific heat?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now, what is the point? So suppose, so we, now we get a slope,
uh-huh,
proportional temperature. First let's get spin susceptibility. Okay, let's do spin susceptibility first. Yes.
Can we first okay. get entropy as a function?
Oh yes, entropy. Oh, absolutely, entropy.
Let's do entropy.
Okay. Absolutely, there is residual entropy because even at zero temperature, occupation numbers are fractional.
Yeah.
So entropy is minus, you know, log n plus one minus n log one minus n. Okay, and we can plug here zero value of occupation number and get non-zero number. So point is, once we have this occupation number, we have non-zero residual entropy at zero temperature, okay?
And what is the temperature dependence of the entropy?
Yes, the temperature depends, in the first approximation, no dependence. Because you see, we increase temperature, but occupation numbers stay approximately the same.
So
that means derivative is zero, that means contribution to specific heat from this thermal condensate state is zero. It does not contribute to specific heat.
But at the same time, if I just use distribution function...
Yes.
And,
yes, you'll get the same result. It turns out you'll get the same result.
Same means what, zero?
No, it means a contribution to specific heat is zero. Yes, contribution of the condensate to specific heat is zero. There's contribution from this side, you know, where there is distortion. But that part, because psi is proportional to temperature, you can easily see it because this ratio, epsilon divided by T, because epsilon is proportional to T, right?
Yes.
It doesn't depend on temperature.
And so
when you differentiate in temperature, you get zero. Okay? So system...
Oh, but you assume that epsilon is just P independent constant proportional to T.
Exactly.
But as you draw it, it's not P independent constant. There's something wrong with the figure.
Here?
No, here there is a slope as a function of momentum.
Yes, yes.
No, if you have a slope as a function of momentum, then immediately you have...
No.
Slope comes from this part. You see, occupation numbers depend on P. So you can differentiate this in P and get non-zero derivative on P coming from this. But the magnitude of that derivative is proportional to T.
Can you write down epsilon of P at finite temperature?
Say again?
Can you write down epsilon of P at finite temperature close to P?
Here.
No, epsilon of P, just a function.
Epsilon of P is function of P.
Express n of p.
Okay, you just take n of p, plug it here, and you
if
get...
If it's linear in momentum, then I don't understand how...
No, sorry. I mean, it's not linear. Okay. It's not exactly linear expansion of momentum. It's not straight line. Okay.
No,
I agree. It's not a straight line. But it's a continuous function that interpolates, but it has a slope. I mean, it's not straight line, but
then the question is this. If you have dispersion,
yes,
that is linear in p minus pf, with some coefficient,
yes,
why cannot I just then use a standard machinery and calculate specific?
Absolutely. No. Okay. Let's do this. Let's do spin susceptibility. Let's do spin susceptibility.
Is it true that the slope is exponentially small in T?
No. Slope is proportional to T. Epsilon is proportional to T.
Slope versus P.
That's slope versus P. Means variation of slope.
In your plot, there is epsilon versus P at
yes.
different temperatures.
Except for one temperature.
So for some
suppose you
small
do it.
Non-zero
okay.
temperature,
want,
what is that slope at that temperature?
Okay.
That's what I'm
okay.
questioning.
You want this slope. It's not a straight line. I cannot draw it. I mean, I don't know how exactly it looks. I can do a slope at the Fermi level.
Yeah,
okay, fine, no problem. Just differentiate this in P. G over dP. What depends on P? N depends on P, right? So you get T, differentiate this, minus 1 minus NP, differentiate this, plus 1 over N minus of P, okay? And take what is your NP, plug it here, and get a slope.
And how does it depend on temperature?
Here, temperature is in front.
It's linear.
Yes, it's linear, it's on
temperature.
The whole curve is proportional to temperature.
So it's P minus PF times T times something.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so let's do spin susceptibility. Okay, so you apply some magnetic field and you want to see what is the magnetic moment, right? So standard formula is spin susceptibility nothing but integral dn occupation number d mu or whatever d epsilon integral dp, right? The standard formula, right? Textbook formula. So we take Fermi function, chemical potential is here. So we differentiate this point, right? So we differentiate this formula in mu, right? So what we get? We get 1 over t in front, because t is here. And then we get derivative of that function, which is exponential epsilon t1 plus epsilon t squared, integral dp, right? But this function you can conveniently rewrite, it's just identical, rewritten. You can write it as n of p times 1 minus n of p integral dp, right? I mean, this is just simple algebra, right? And now we take integral of this function from this point, p1 and p2, between these points where the Fermi concept exists. So here we get some integral. Because n of p is different from 0 and 1, the integrand is non-zero, you get some number. Let's call it eta. So what you find is that your specific, your spin susceptibility is eta divided by t. So what you get is Curie. We get Curie law. But spin susceptibility, so spin susceptibility is inversely proportional to temperature. Not surprising, because slope is proportional to temperature, right? With some weight, with some factor weight, which is the integral, which is basically proportional to the size of this area, because it comes from this integral. And it can be small. I mean, if Fermi concept forms a small area, this number may be small, okay? So what we get is Curie behavior, but the number of that means like localized spins. So basically, this Fermi condensate at finite temperatures, it basically mimics behavior of localized spins. So what effect do we get from an experimental point of view? We got effective localized spin behavior, okay, out of itinerative electrons.
And the
number of those effective localized spins is adjustable parameter. It's not total number of elections. It depends on this, you know, how big is the Fermi
tension. But there's nothing about localization as a problem.
It's the peak in the density of states.
Yes.
Mimics F electrons in the...
Exactly. This peak in density of states. And, you know, at zero temperature, velocity is zero. You might say velocity is zero, electrons don't move. I mean, so it's not Anderson localization by any means. It's not Anderson localization. It comes purely from interaction, internal interaction between electrons. And they kind of, you know, effectively localize, meaning they don't move. But they don't relocalize like in there. And they always remember that somewhere down there, underlying, the underlying nature is itinerant. But interactions happen to be so consistent so that some portion of them become effectively, you know, mimics localized spin behavior. Okay? So you get Curie-wise behavior out of itinerant interactions and Landau theory.
This is both the indication for the entropy and the susceptibility.
Yes.
Mostly it suggests that this is an interesting state which eventually will be unstable.
Absolutely. Yes.
But do you have any feeling from within this theory?
Yes.
When it is going to be?
Okay. Stable? Okay. Now I absolutely agree. Now we clearly see that in fact this state will surely be unstable at zero temperature. Okay. Because, well, there is peak in density of states, okay? And all kind of instabilities allow, you know, peaks of density of states. For example, ferromagnetism, anti-ferromagnetism, superconductivity, whatever. You know, all of them like, you know, big density of states. Or put it a different way, residual entropy. Surely system would like to get rid of residual, you know, make some ordered state and get rid of residual entropy. So in other words, this Fermi condensate state is really not observed, it's impossible to observe in pure form at zero temperature. It's like quarks, you know, they exist, but you cannot separate them, okay? What you can observe is a finite temperature manifestations, okay? You can observe finite temperature manifestations of Fermi condensates. If you increase temperature, then you may kill these transitions because they depend on their, you know, interaction constant. And at the finite temperature, you see a Curie-wise behavior, which is signature of Fermi condensate. So you see, yeah. Okay?
Victor, just for a record, you didn't finish about specific heat. Just
yes, as I said, the contribution to specific heat for Fermi condensate is zero. That means specific heat will be about the same as in Fermi gas, meaning this part, dispersive part, this other part, you know, outside the Fermi condensate, they will give you regular specific heat, you know, Fermi heat related specific heat, and contribution of this portion will be approximately zero. So there's nothing special, there will be no singular, you know, no, nothing special. There are no special signatures in specific heat.
So specific heat will diverge as a transition point, but if you go into the condensed phase, it will go back to...
Exactly. It will diverge at the transition point with a inflection point, but then will go back to Fermi liquid value. Or maybe perhaps some normalized number, but basically Fermi liquid value. Okay, fine. So now, I guess it's time to show you some experimental data to support this. Let's see. Seven. Yes. Okay, Fermi leap. Okay, now back to Fermi. Okay, so now what we go back to helium experiment. And remember, I was showing you this paper, Bunko, whatever, Gottfried, extremely low temperature measurements in helium 3. But there was one more figure, there were other figures in the paper which I didn't show you. Okay, so this is the same paper Gottfried by Bunko I was showing before. I was showing you three curves, remember, when was temperature, 0.6. So these are the three curves, okay? Now they are plotted. You see what's plotted here is magnetization, that is skin sensitivity, times temperature. It's multiplied by temperature. S function of temperature. Now, all these three curves go to zero because even though specifically it was divergent at zero temperature, but it was sublinear, okay? So when you multiply by temperature, you make them all go to zero. But if you increase concentration more by another 10%, you get this curve, which has finite limit. You see, it has finite limit of sensitivity multiplied by T at zero temperature. So that is Curie behavior. So in other words, as you push system, in a phase diagram across, across the critical point, well, then you get Curie behavior, okay? Out of each other, helium atoms, okay?
So if he plotted those data before, when yes. You had the line at the lowest temperature, and you said, look, it's 1 over T to the 0.6 disagrees with my 2/3, if you'd done it for those data, you would in fact get not 0.6 for the exponent, but you'd get 1.
Yes, that is right. Unfortunately, this curve, is not shown on that plot. I mean, they have the data, but they didn't do it. But yes, I'm sure if they did, yes, slope must be the same, 1 over T, yes.
Just remind one thing, how chi behaved at the transition point?
Okay, now, let's be careful.
That's a question, what's chi at the transition point?
Chi was 1 over 2 to the 2/3. One over two thirds is sublinear, so that's why it goes to zero. But no, notice the following. Okay, so here we have Curie behavior, 1/T. But Curie behavior has also some exponent. I mean, numerator has some numerator, which is roughly like you can say it's number of localized spins. But you see, number of localized is substantially small if you have high temperature. You see, this is high temperature. High temperature also has Curie, right? And high temperatures is non-degenerate Fermi gas, so the numerator here is just number of electrons. And this is a number, okay? At low temperature, you recover again localized spins, but effective number of electrons is about 4 times smaller. So if you say electrons localized, it's only 1/4 localized. What happens to 3/4? Okay, if you literally take electrons, localize each of them. No problem in this theory, because numerator in this theory is essentially the area, basically the area occupied by Fermi dependency, and it's a fraction. So no problem getting 1/4.
And again, this is now you're saying this happens on the condensate.
Yes, so this is on the condensate side of the phase diagram.
What is the specific heat on this side?
Okay, now specific heat was not measured in this paper. These people did not measure it. So what can I say?
But
the other group measured, but they have different substrate, different temperature, they can go to low temperature.
But still, the question is this. You showed us the data which show mass diverging.
Yes.
What happens? Did anyone measure it on the other side?
Okay. This is
not these people, just genuinely. Did anyone
No, but there are only two or three groups in the world who do this, So I mean there are
no
other.
So that's right, no.
Can you show us some data where there is more than one experiment?
Yes. I mean I was showing
right you now, but we have this data from unpublished sounders. Mm-hmm. We have that. Probably in several weeks.
Okay.
But they publish this.
Yeah, okay, so more data will come in the future. But as of now, I'll show you two papers. All the data were taken from two papers by two experimental groups. And that's about all, that we were able to find. Maybe more exist, but we're not experts.
So the answer is no, there is no data on the
side. There is no good, put this in, there is no good data, There is no good data,
What about bad data?
Come on.
Yeah. Okay. Look. I'm not going to show you anyway. Look. It's useless to press me because I'm not going to show you. I'm not going to show it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway. So now that was about helium and everything. So it looks fine. It looks like it works fine. Or maybe I should mention that for two-dimensional reaction gas, reactions on the silicon surface. Okay. They also show. I don't know show the data, but qualitatively I can tell. They measured one group measured basically magnetization, and what they see crossover from Pauli-like behavior to Curie-like behavior. So they go across metal-to-air transitions, goes from Pauli to Curie, So qualitatively similar, but you know, but the quality of the data is not good to do any you know, any more precise statements. So it doesn't prove anything, but it goes in the same along the same. It's consistent, but doesn't prove anything. Okay, qualitatively. But anyway, so this was all about, I want to say about this, you know, isotropic system. Now let's go to Herr-Feldman.
Can we actually? I'm sure you can just to the data which are anomalous, and the theory is anomalous, and we can somehow sensibly fit them.
Yes.
But I would rather actually discuss the theoretical aspect of that than.
Okay, look, I'm over time already. I have about 5 or 10 minutes left, right?
Yeah,
so I cannot go in all possible directions you'd like to go, you know. Okay, let me do, you know, let me finish what I want to say, and, you know, we can go all the directions in the future 10 years, you know. This is really a problem for 10 years ahead, right? So anyway, so what about, you know, Herr-Feldman? Well, I showed you those two swords, right? Powers to swords, that kind of fractional powers like that, right? I mean, some of them are absorbed in Herr-Feldman. I mean, not uncommon in Herr-Feldman. Did I show another slide? Yes, not uncommon in Herr-Feldman. Now, of course, Herr-Feldman, for example, let's give you an example. So this paper, the Kakashi, etc. So this is cerium, ruthenium, silicon. Okay, and it happened to have, seems like this material, this particular material, has critical point right at ambient pressure, right at zero doping. Okay, so anyway, so this is C-susceptibility, actually AC susceptibility, that means derivative, DMGH, as function of temperature. As function for different fields, you know, depends on magnetic field applied. But if you apply the lowest possible field, like field of Earth, it actually goes like this and actually follows two-thirds. I mean, they didn't do the fit, but other people, Hodder and collaborators, they actually did the fit and it actually follows two-thirds. For comparison, this is 1/T. Experimenters themselves plotted 1/T, and it's clear that the data goes, you know, is less single than 1/T. But the fit, but you know, one can do fit over two-thirds and fit it. Okay. Well, anyway, so that's for temperature dependence of spin susceptibility. You might ask, how about magnetization? They also did static. This is just magnetization in static. Mm-hmm. A function of field normalized to temperature. Now, of course, you see, it depends on both magnetic field and temperature, right? But if you go to high enough field, in field higher than temperature, it saturates, right? So it saturates. So at high, you know, field stronger than temperature, you have magnetization. And you can read all these numbers. You see magnetization at this field, and that field, and so on. So if you take those numbers, that's what I did yesterday, and plot magnetization as function of cubic root of h, well, you get kind of straight line, at least, you know, it's not a Kaspi line, okay? So in other words, we have kind of those rules, m proportional to h over 3, you know, higher to source, and this is very simple-minded analysis, but one can do more detailed, more accurate analysis. This was done by Hodder and collaborators. They basically, this is normalized spin susceptibility plotted as function of normalized temperature, meaning, you know, you have scaling as function of field divided by temperature, okay? So the points, experimental points, they collapse. So this collapse of the points was shown in the original paper, okay? But what these people did, they did calculation. So this can be calculated, you know, quantitatively on computer and those numbers and everything. So this hand-waving picture has been done. And so it lines actually computer calculations corresponding to this picture. And we see, you know, the fit data quite well.
I'm sorry.
I mean, for inflection point, assuming that there is an inflection point, yes.
Do you call the left? Lower left figure collapse?
This, I mean, what? I mean,
on the high side.
Yes.
Now.
Okay, look. The circles here are experimental points collapsed by experimentalists themselves. In fact, I can tell there are only three concentrations here, three, actually, these three. So actually, they collapse these three.
Difference by factor of two.
Okay, fine. You can send email to these people and say, look, the collapse that
you are showing us this data. Is it a good collapse or not?
No. I mean, the point, no. The point is this. The point is not to get accuracy of 1%. Okay?
Okay.
In most cases, you can't get accuracy of 1%. What I'm saying is it qualitatively captures the right behavior. It's not crazy behavior. It's not unreasonable. But it's not perfect to 1%.
Can I make the observation?
Yes.
When you collapse those, they have it on a log scale vertically,
yeah.
And this is a linear scale. So I know it looks bad, but
yeah.
The pictures you're used to saying, uh-huh. Oh, that's a wonderful collapse.
Yeah, sure.
It's on a log vertical scale.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree. This log of temperature, if you report it in real scale, well, it would be much bigger. Yeah.
Since we're approaching.
Yes. The last
yeah, time. Yeah. After you maybe say this, basically, just want to ask a question now. You present a picture when for me liquid itself exists as a critical point in the sense that quasi-particle do exist. It's yes, just their velocity vanishes.
Yes, yes.
Alternative scenario that we hear many times is when Fermi liquid disappears because Z factor vanishes.
Okay.
Just you don't have quasi-particles.
Okay.
Did you think about experiment?
Yes.
That would distinguish between these two scenarios.
Uh-huh. In other words, experiment to measure Z factor.
Maybe to measure Z factor, because 2/3 were presented as coming from...
Okay, let me put it this way. If you guys come up with experiment to measure Z factor and demonstrate your behavior predicted by Z factor, I would be happy to see. I don't know how to measure Z factor. Okay?
So the answer is no, you don't know.
No. I think about this theory. I don't spend much time thinking about Z factors. There are plenty of other people who hopefully will figure it out. Okay? I know. I'm focusing on this.
It's more than the fact. It's a question whether quasi-particles exist as a critical factor.
But again, look, it is in that alternative scenario that quasi-particles disappear. So if you guys give, convince an experiment to probe disappearance of quasi-particles, it would be great. But, in my picture, don't disappear, so I don't have to worry about this. You guys have to worry about that. Okay? Anyway, the last step, the very last one, this last transparency, okay? So there was superconductivity. I told you that this, as it was pointed out, this state is unstable with respect to all kinds of phase transitions, ferromagnetic, anti-ferromagnetic, we have seen plenty of those, but also superconductivity. Superconductivity also allows high density of states, right? And in fact, it does happen. So, this is very, very, very kind of puzzling behavior. This plutonium material, okay? So this measures spin susceptibility, function of temperature, and you see basically Curie law. Well, Curie wise size is a bit small, but anyway, basically Curie law. So you look in this picture, you say, well, look, these are localized spins, right? Curie law. And then boom, at 18 Kelvin, pretty high temperature, bam, system becomes superconduction. It superconducts us right out of localized spin state. How come? Okay? In this picture, no problem. Because in this picture, electrons, deep in their heart, they are generative electrons. And so what happens is this, you have this big density of state. And finite entropy. System would surely want to get rid of this. How to get rid? It can open BCS gap. So these reactions can form BCS pairing. No problem with that. That was proposed already in the original papers. They form BCS pairing, open the gap, okay, and so remove that flat part from the ferment surface, have an energy gap and gain energy. Okay? And this is very favorable, favorable transition to condensed phase decay and so on. So system make, and once this happens, all you basically recover regular ferment quasi particles, but with superconduction, that's what observed here. Okay? Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Question maybe following up on Andre. What it seems to me, you're saying, I will develop eventually this theory, some sort of a peak around the density phase around the Fermi surface, but I won't really see it because there will be an instability.
Yes, absolutely.
Imagine I'm dealing with a conda system.
Yes.
Where coming from somewhere at high energy, I would notice that they have a tendency of developing this peak.
Yes, yes.
How do you distinguish your scenario from something like that?
Yes, I understand that peaks can come from different origins like conda. Okay, let me put it this way. I'm not an expert in conda physics. Okay? So I can tell you about this scenario. I cannot tell you much about conda. I'm really not an expert in conda. I think plenty of other people are experts in conda. Okay? So, let's get together and see how we can distinguish these two scenarios. Because I'm not an expert in conda. But just one observation. So this kind of superconductivity out of so-called localized field is observed not only on plutonium material, but also on this other material, cerium, cobalt, indium. It shows this localized spin behavior and superconductivity. But interestingly, if you substitute plutonium but uranium, it just happens that it shows no localized spin. It shows power susceptibility, Fermi liquid, and no superconductivity. Okay? Because having this peak at the Fermi level is very favorable for superconductivity. If you destroy it, just replace one element, you destroy superconductivity as well.
So the statement is that cerium, cobalt, indium 5 is already in a fermionic condensed phase.
Yes. The statement is these two materials, this one and that one, are in Fermion condensate state and have superconductivity out of it. This material is not in Fermion condensate and have no superconductivity.
Okay.
And that's it.
Victor, quick question. The discussions before were basically focused on this stuff. Whatever quantum critical point you consider, resistivity is always linear.
Oh, resistivity.
Yeah.
Can
you comment?
I can. Yeah. I systematically avoid talking about resistivity, transient kind of thing. Because transient are very difficult to calculate theoretically. You need the scattering mechanism or umklapp or whatever it is. In fact, what is great about helium? There's no question of what is temperature depends of electrical resistivity. There is no electrical resistivity. All we measure is thermodynamic quantities. That's what makes it great. Unfortunately, the electronic materials, it can be measured, and it is measured all the time, and it depends on us questions all the time. But theoretically, it's much more difficult and, you know, controversial questions to calculate. So in other words, thermodynamic quantities like spin subtubularity, specific heat, that kind of stuff. You know, it's much more reliable in the theory. And transport is much less reliable. So there are results. I mean, I'm not saying there are results. There are results in papers. For example, at inflection point, temperature difference will be 2/3. If you have inflection point, then the result will be 2/3. And in fact, there is a recent preprint where we actually observed 2/3, which has a phrase.
Yeah.
So point is, I mean, there are all kind of powers: 2/3, 1/3, 3/2. I mean, this power is all over the place.
And is you constant plus t to the 2/3 or just t to the 2/3?
Okay, they show a phase diagram. There are three regions on the phase diagram. Mm-hmm. In one, it's linear for power 1. In one, it's power 2/3, and one is power square, t square. So in other words, you can have all kind of powers of resistivity, you know, all the whole zoo of those powers. And I'm not really in a position to, you know, say anything sensible about that as of now, you know, as of this talk.
Well, it's kind of a zoo of powers.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, these people say the observation of power 2/3 was largely unnoticed by the community. So, I mean, what is noticed by the community, what is emphasized, what is de-emphasized, I don't know. Look at this, I'm not an expert in those terms, because, you know, there is maybe no zero power, but zero materials. And I'm certainly not, you know, expert to, you know, to tell, to speak about all of them. Yes,
In the fermionic condensate,
yes.
Just forget about conductivity,
right. Yes.
Have some finite number of scatterers.
Right.
That leads
like
to
impurities.
Okay. That in metal will give you constant plus t squared. What's the theoretical anticipated resistance? Because maybe, I mean, you get
to the what is the resistivity on impurities?
It's constant.
Constant. Okay. So if it's impurity, it's constant.
No. But if you have a power that your Fermi velocity, at the critical point, your Fermi, the velocity at the Fermi surface vanishes.
Yes.
So that's why I'm confused.
I see. Okay. Now, look. To do this, we need another, you know, maybe 10 minutes or so to derive it. I mean, it's non-trivial. I mean, it's completely non-trivial. It's a very non-trivial question.
We
can sit and discuss. It's in the paper. We can discuss it, but, you know, it's not one line. It's not one line calculation. It's more complicated.
Victor, this would be easier if there was a question. Can you just give the answer?
Yes. So what was the question?
I just wanted to guess.
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
So, I'm finished basically, but you know. Yeah.
Again, we all agree it's unstable at low temperatures. Mm-hmm. What I don't know is whether there's a window where it exists in between.
Yes, it's a very interesting scenario.
But there must be some way that from within you can say the entropy. Will basically require me to make this unstable on the scale of EF.
Mm-hmm.
Then I know it's not going to happen, right? Is there an internal consistency argument that this ever exists?
I think the current belief is that it's like quartz, as I said. It's never possible to observe it, you know, in... Just put it this way. For one thing, you cannot reach zero temperature, for one thing, right? Experimentally, you cannot reach zero temperature.
Yeah, but I expect that's not exactly the limitation you're talking about.
So, you know, experimentally, we're always talking about some finite temperature. And the question is, that finite temperature, is it above transition or below transition?
Exactly.
Look at the helium, by the way, stuff. So transition temperature depends on two things, as you know. It depends on density of states and an appropriate interaction constant in that channel.
Mm-hmm.
The different channels have different interaction constants, superconductivity, thermodynamics, and conductivity. You know, they have appropriate constants in those channels. So you have to take that constant in that channel, multiply by density of states, which progressively increases as you decrease temperature, and at some point, you feel instability.
I think that's much simpler.
Yeah.
You have a low temperature ordered state, which tells you what the temperature and the entropy is.
Oh, okay.
You have a high temperature entropy.
Ah, okay. Okay, fine,
tells
fine.
You
fine,
order.
Fine.
Is that crossing
fine.
Point above EF?
Cost reestablish.
Yeah, cost reestablish, exactly. Cost reestablish, right.
If that temperature is above the EF of the problem,
right.
Throw away the theory if it's way below and keep it.
Yes, exactly.
Have you answered that question?
No, but we're trying to approach this transition from two different points. I say, let's start from upper temperature and heat and stability. You start something from below. And see where, you know, sure, I mean, that's exactly how it works.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Other questions?
Can anyone explain these data?
Which data? This data?
Look, in your model, you said in the very beginning, no electron, no condo physics, mm-hmm. no. So there's no way your model mm-hmm. other than the fact it accidentally comes uh-huh. up with the same answer,
yes.
purports to address this.
Yeah. All right.
By their theories.
Uh-huh. No, I mean that it's not a completely true, because suppose that you have a Kondo state, you form a new band between the electron and the conduction one. So like, if you have a single impurity of a program, the band is a completely flat. But because you have a singlet which is localized. But now suppose that you have a lattice, this singlet can move. So the natural equation, it is the same than here. What is the band structure of this new fermion? So typically, I would say that the equation are quite similar.
If the quantum temperature is about 3 microns.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I mean, quantum physics, you know, is obviously the main staple, you know, in this business. And you know, I'm not trying to say that quantum physics is wrong. I mean, maybe it is. I mean, if quantum people can explain it, fine with me. I mean, Pierce, in fact, we had discussion. Pierce proposed. I learned about this from Pierce Coleman discussion, and he was making a list of how we can explain. For example, like, you know, spins make, you know, BCS condensate or something of that kind. I don't understand, you know. But, you know, he had to form BCS condensate out of, you know, Kondo or whatever, spins, you know. Maybe it's possible, that's fine. I'm not an expert on that. Ask Pierce, you know, he might have his own, you know, good scenario for that. All I'm saying is that, you know, we propose an alternative kind of approach where we have very similar phenomena in systems which do not have reactions. And then we say, well, look, I mean, maybe the same physics is appropriate here. But it's, you know, I don't claim that quantum is irrelevant. I mean, that's not up to me to decide whether quantum is irrelevant or not.
It's just a model mm-hmm. with a sort of a single band with a stranger band structure.
Exactly, exactly.
And
yes.
For instance, recently, Catherine Pepin wrote a paper uh-huh. in a PRL with uh-huh. the same kind of ideas oh. applied to a LDO fermion and Pierce uh-huh. as well since few years.
Okay, so I need to look at this paper.
So the question is, what is the band structure mm-hmm. of this new fermion right. formed between the conduction band?
Okay. Yeah. I need to look at this. But that's right. It's single band picture with very simple minor fermions, and you know, and try to go as far as possible.
In Katri's paper, it was really complete phenomenological idea that uh-huh. this portion is cubic around.
Yes. Oh, they proposed cubic.
Yeah.
Oh, we certainly need to look at this paper.
Yes. Uh-huh. But it was just phenomenology. They just uh-huh. said, let's
yes,
assume.
It's more
over this,
the entire Fermi surface, but it's
I try to avoid details.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, I certainly must look at this paper. Okay.
Okay, thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks.